Sorry.
Welcome. Welcome back to Uniting Narratives, for those listening, for my friends listening. Today I'm excited to introduce Professor Coleman. She holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy and biology from DeSales University. I said that right?
Yep.
She went on to earn her master's in theological studies with a concentration in biotechnology from the John Paul II Institute at the Catholic University of America. Continuing her academic journey, she also received her PhD in theology from the same institution. So this is the first episode that I think will set the path forward for me in Uniting Narratives, because I want to interview professors of political science, theology, and philosophy, but ask them beforehand what they want me to look into, what work they've done in the past that they really enjoyed and have kind of committed their life to a certain degree, or at least a part of their life to, because I noticed that all the professors at Assumption, at least the ones I've interacted with, they seem like they've spent so much time on certain subjects, and I guess that's required to get a PhD. Yeah. So I want to try to get some of that knowledge and then make it available to some friends and family. So I want to focus on metaphysics because I know nothing about it, and you have mentioned that you've spent an absurd amount of time kind of studying it, which kind of freaks me out a little bit. Like, I'm just worried for you on that front. But
indeed, I am a metaphysician.
Okay, cool. So I want to talk about what that is, but before we dive into these specific questions, can you distinguish, I don't want to take too much time with this, but can you help distinguish philosophy and theology for those who might not be familiar? And then we'll talk about how metaphysics fits into those.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, you said you don't want to take too much time on this, and that's fine. I'll do it quickly. But I also just want to say that you could talk about this for, I mean, people have talked about this for literally millennia now. Like, what's the difference between the two? But so theology, right, properly speaking, is the logos, right, study of God. Philosophy is the love of wisdom. But discipline-wise, they overlap a lot, right? And so it kind of depends on who you ask, right? Because in both philosophy and theology, you're kind of studying everything, right? Both philosophy and theology take the entire world as like their area of study. Or actually, I should even say it's more broad, all of reality. So then the question is, then, is there any difference between the two, right? If it's not their subject matter that distinguishes them, because that's true of every other discipline, like what's that discipline's subject matter, then what is the difference? And so in my mind, here's what I've come to. So this is somewhat unique to me, not completely unique to me. It's informed by other thinkers. But philosophy kind of starts with the data of reality that you just get by living, right, and moves upward. It starts asking questions, right? Like, why am I here? Why is everything else here, right? And by moving upwards, so to speak, a lot of times, not all the time, but philosophers will get to some kind of like ultimate cause, right? So Aristotle gets to the unmoved mover, right? That kind of thing. So philosophy ends up talking about what we would call God, but it starts with kind of like the data of reality, right? Does that make sense?
So is it moving upwards or is it moving backwards?
Yeah. But I mean, yes. Yeah, I think backwards is another great way to put it. Yeah. Okay. I'm kind of using the classic like up, God is up, God, kind, okay, of, but you're right. Like, if you're asking about causes, which is like what Aristotle says philosophy is about, mm-hmm, actually, okay, right? Then backwards is probably a great way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Okay.
So then theology, on the other hand, starts with God, right? It starts with certain facts about God, essentially, right? But through revelation, right? That God is a Trinity, that God became man, et cetera, right? That God created the world. It starts with revealed information, and then it asks questions about the rest of the world in light of that revealed information.
So was theology not possible before certain revelations?
Yes. So I would actually say that Christianity invented theology, right? Other religions since Christianity have kind of responded and been like, oh, we can think about our religion as well in this way that Christianity has decided to think about itself, right? Something you're very familiar with at this point, right? Christianity's decision for philosophy, mm-hmm. right? But there were, theology did not exist prior to Christianity.
Interesting. So people who study the Islamic faith, do they call their practice, if they're inquiring into what the text means, are they calling it theology? Or
they mostly do not call it theology. Okay. Very rarely. Like, sometimes Christians will use that for what, you know, Islamic scholars will do. Okay. But they often just think of themselves as scholars of Islam. That's that's how they would consider themselves. Yeah.
So you said you start with the facts of God, and you can get those facts through revelation. And those I'm thinking about the revelation of the burning bush with Moses. That revelation, it has to be, it's not a physical thing. Like, it's not Moses talking to another man and that other man told him something that was so powerful that it inspired all these people. It was like a spirit or some sort of thing that wasn't physical came down and spoke to him. So when you started studying, did you start studying metaphysics because you realized like there was something not physical about theology that you had to just get to the bottom of or start digging at? And then does every theologian do that?
No and no. So first of all, I just want to say, I'm not sure if I would agree that it's simply not a physical phenomenon with, like, for example, let's take the burning bush, right? I mean, if there really was a burning bush, which is, as we're told, right, the whole reason Moses stopped on Mount Horeb to begin with, right? Like, he was like, why isn't that bush burning up, right? Being consumed by the fire. So there's a physical aspect there. And then also, okay, suppose you don't even believe that God, suppose you believe God spoke to Moses, but it wasn't a burning bush. The speaking was kind of a physical phenomenon,
right?
Okay, suppose you don't believe that there was a voice, but that, like, Moses heard something in his own head, right? Moses is a physical being, and so him thinking about it is physical. So, my point is not simply to, like, correct you, but the point is that the metaphysical and the physical never exist without, but rarely exist without each other, right? So, like, So for your listeners, right, just, we get this phrase metaphysics because it's sort of like the, meta means beyond, so beyond the physical, basically. And so I got into metaphysics because I was a biology major and I love biology,
That's cool.
And so my big question in undergrad was basically, I sat into my first philosophy class and it like captured me and I was like, oh my God, you know? So it was Socrates actually. And so we were kind of like asking questions that I didn't even know I had, and then realized that I did have those questions in the philosophy class. And so in undergrad, I was both a biology major and a philosophy major, and I was kind of getting two different worldviews in my bio classes versus my philosophy classes. And I was trying to understand like how the two go together, basically. And so the reason I got into metaphysics is because, so when you ask, when you study biology, right? Biology is literally the study of life. Bios means life in Greek. Okay, well, the first basic question then is, what is life? And you don't answer that in biology. That's not a biological question. You answer that question in philosophy, right? What constitutes life, actually, right? This is one of the many reasons there's a big debate about whether viruses are alive, right?
Okay.
So what I saw was that I wasn't going to be able to reconcile philosophy and biology if I stayed on the level of both just regular philosophy and regular biology. I needed to kind of go deeper to see where the two met. And where the two meet, right, is in metaphysics. So for example, the question is what is life? That's a metaphysical question, right? Because even though life is physical, to like you can sort of point to something and say that's alive, but then when you ask the question, what makes it alive, or what is life? That's a metaphysical question. It goes deeper than the physical, right? Or beyond the physical. And so that's why I ended up following metaphysics, getting into metaphysics.
Okay. But in a biology class, the professor would say this thing is living. Like, to study life, you have to pick which things are living and which things are not living, right?
Right.
And so they wouldn't consider a rock living.
No.
In biology. So what's the, wouldn't the criteria give some sort of like the criteria of,
yeah, they tend to start with like cells basically, right? But like when I sort of like, if I mean, and I've done this, right? Like I've asked biologists, like who I've been in dialogue with, but like what makes a cell alive, right? And then, right.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. You see like what makes, like you can tell the difference between something that's alive and not alive. We all can tell the difference. Like dogs can tell the difference, right? Between alive and not alive, right? Generally, sometimes they get confused by like plastic bags that,
sure,
move around.
Yeah.
But then the deeper question is like, what makes, what constitutes life, right?
So it seems like maybe Aristotle got to something like this. That's
absolutely
why he said that we need to study the causes, because we can point that that's life, but we need to figure out what caused life to figure out anything.
Absolutely.
Really cool.
And that's a metaphysical question, according to Aristotle.
Okay.
Yeah. So I always want to see where philosophy, theology, and science, but specifically biology, come together. That's like why I got into metaphysics, because like I want to sort of like understand the root of all the questions, basically, and where these disciplines kind of meet each other. And to answer your other question earlier, not every theologian does that, right? Like, in fact, most don't. I'm a kind of a rare breed. There's generally more metaphysicians that are more strictly philosophical than there are theological. So I am kind of like a strange one.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'll frame this appropriately, because I've taken one biology class, but would someone respond to what you said about kind of needing metaphysics to look at the question of what is life deeper? Could they say, well, if you go back very far, you'll see the cells, it's like the prokaryote or the...
Yep, and eukaryotes and prokaryotes.
Yeah. And one of the cells hit another cell in a certain way that they combined, and then evolution started to occur from I guess that moment or the moment before that, and that's the cause of life. That's what life is. So how would you respond to someone with such a compelling evolutionary argument?
Yeah, I mean, notice that you said like evolution, like, yeah, happened, right? Which tends to, no, but like, I mean, and that's not simply because you don't know a lot of biology. That actually tends to be like the answer for a lot of these questions. Like, it's basically like hashtag evolution is the answer. And then I'm always like, but what does that mean, right? So when you read Darwin's Origin of Species, which is where kind of like the first major theory of evolution comes about, he just uses nature. He says nature, like, but he uses it like capital N, and he says like nature does this and nature does that, and nature like weeds out the weak, right? And nature allows for the survival of the fittest. And then what is this nature, Darwin? What do you mean by that, right? Like, so that's like one of the major questions that like a lot of philosophers have for evolutionary biology. And to its credit, evolutionary biology is also like, in many people are kind of coming to terms with those questions. So there's a whole area of evolutionary biology that they call themselves Aristotelian evolutionary biologists, right? Because they believe in teleology, which is like that a telos is an end, meaning like that towards which something is pointed, right? Mm-hmm. Like your purpose would be another way to put it. And so like there's a whole group of evolutionary biologists that sort of are like, listen, this thing we're calling evolution doesn't make any sense unless we think that like things have purposes that are built into them, right? And so this is what Aristotle calls something's final end, right? Its telos is its purpose, right? And so it's, that's one of the causes, according to Aristotle, right, is the telos. So like a lot of times with regard to biology, evolution does a lot of heavy lifting that kind of hides a lot of philosophical presuppositions within there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when I asked you what specific paper or video you wanted me to watch to prepare for this, you gave me this lecture you gave on online for the, is it the Zephyr
Institute?
The Zephyr Institute. And I'll link that in the description. I recommend everyone to watch that after you listen to this, or before. You can pause this and go listen to this because it's a really cool lecture. And you explored Ferdinand Ulrich.
You got it.
Ulrich's position of being as gift, and mentioned that Ulrich was concerned with meta-anthropology rather than metaphysics in general. So if I skipped over something, point that out, but what is meta-anthropology? We kind of just talked about metaphysics. What is meta-anthropology?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say Ulrich's, well, he does both, right? And for Ulrich, what he calls meta-anthropology is like the culmination of metaphysics, right? So if metaphysics is asking these questions about causes, right? And like kind of like the deep structures of reality, we might say, right? How do things work? Why do things like appear the way they do, right? Then Ulrich's contention is that all of being, right, or all of reality, like is kind of aiming at man, right? Like that it's that like being wants to be man, so to speak, right? Because like you, like, I mean, if being had wants, right, or desires, right, like being like would want to be man because it gets to like do the most as a man, basically, right? Like you get to be freer and do more stuff and know more things as a man than as a dog, than as a rock, right? Like, et cetera, right? And so meta-anthropology is just kind of asking the same questions we ask in metaphysics, but with regard to humans in particular.
Okay. Could I sum that up and say that humans are the telos?
Yes.
Of creation?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay. And so how does meta-anthropology differ from anthropocentrism, which you mentioned in that lecture?
Yeah. So you can have a real anthropocentric, a kind of bad anthropocentric view of the world, meaning everything is here just to serve man, right? Everything is here for like our pleasure and comfort, right? Everything is here for us, for man to use, right, as he wills, right? And not have any responsibility toward at all, right? So if you could, one of the ways to kind of misconstrue this is, to misconstrue saying that man is the telos of creation is to say then man can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants, to anything he wants in the world. And that would be a mistake, right? And we can get into why, like, Ulrich thinks that would be a mistake, and a lot of people in the tradition would be think it's a mistake. But to say that human being is like the apex of reality or the telos of creation is not to say, right, it's not the exact same thing as saying that then man gets to do whatever he wants no matter what.
Okay. I think we should talk about that.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah, if we are the apex, if we are the most capable, then shouldn't we use that potential and create the world as we please and do kind of really just what we want?
Whatever we want, yeah.
I mean, I don't agree with this, but I think it's
no, it's a good worth question. Getting into. So this is where meta-anthropology needs metaphysics, right? Because if you simply say, well, man's the best, right? And you don't kind of look at the rest of being or the rest of beings, right? Individual beings and their causes and their purposes, right? Then you can just sort of say that, well, everything's purpose is just to please man. And that can't simply be true, right? Or at least I'll stick with that. It can't simply be true. So for example, right, it's really important to look at other beings' causes, right, including their own. So the the plural of telos is teli. So including their other beings, teli. So like, for example, let's think about like a chicken, right? So like, what is the telos of a chicken? What's its purpose?
I mean, I enjoy eggs every morning.
I mean, so do I.
Okay.
But just looking at the chicken by itself, what's its purpose?
I don't know.
What do you think? What do chickens do naturally?
Produce food?
No. They are food for other animals too, but like, to excise a man out of it.
Okay.
Right? What do chickens, like, what do they do? What's their purpose?
I don't know. It doesn't seem like they have any purpose.
So you have an anthropocentric worldview.
I guess so. It doesn't seem like
they have any purpose. I mean, what is any animal's, like, purpose, generally?
To reproduce?
Yeah, exactly, right? To make, like, so to make more chickens, okay. Right? And how do chickens make more chickens?
By finding other chickens.
Right, other chickens, right? And, like, generally you're going to make more chickens, right? If you're a chicken, if you're, like, good and a healthy chicken, right?
Right,
like,
okay, right,
and
right.
You're, like, in the place you're supposed to be in.
Right.
Right, that kind of thing. So if you think of a chicken as just for feeding us, right?
Yeah.
Just for feeding man.
Which I clearly think.
Right? But if you think of him as a chicken as only, its only purpose is for man.
Yeah.
Well, then what's the problem with like factory farming chickens?
Right. Okay. That becomes acceptable.
Exactly. Right. But if you think of a chicken as like its own being that has a purpose in and of itself that we can then maybe harness, right?
Yeah.
But it actually has a purpose in and of itself, then you're going to be like, well, wait a second. The chicken should probably like see the outdoors, be able to walk around, live in sunlight, right? Eat the food it's supposed to eat and not like other chickens, right?
Yeah,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Right? So like,
I feel terrible now. My friend Josh is going to be like, dude, he's a farmer, and he's going to be like, dude, come on. But
so it's like really important that we look at the rest of reality, right? Not as it's all just for man's pleasure and comfort, but like in and of itself, like what are these things' purposes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a steward of being, right? That's being a shepherd of being. I use that phrase in that lecture, right? And that comes from Heidegger too, but that's being a steward of being and a shepherd of being rather than thinking it's all there to serve only you.
So where man differs from chicken is that man is aware of the different purposes or the different telai of these other animals, and that means we actually have the responsibility to care about those.
So yes.
So that is what elevates our purpose compared to other animals. Not necessarily saying ours is more important, but ours simply is what it is, and we have to.
Yes, and it's just higher. It's just higher than the rest of the animals, right? As much as I think like orcas are really cool and like really, really intelligent,
yeah.
They aren't responsible for the rest of reality the way man can be. And man can be that is because man has logos, right? Like, whereas like the rest of the animals don't have it on the same level that man does, right?
Okay. So the next question, I could have asked this question. You mentioned that man is the height of created being, but also its shepherd. We kind of just spoke about that. But I said here, on the one hand, this speaks to our potential, but also our inevitable destruction. Are we inevitably going to destroy ourselves? I'm thinking about climate issues, world wars, etc. Is this a quote, is this what we just spoke about, a way to describe this most fundamental human dilemma? And could this human dilemma exist without a creator?
Yeah.
I don't know if that last question even makes sense.
But I mean, I think this is a fundamental human dilemma, especially as with the rise of technology, right? Before World War II, Martin Heidegger has this essay called The Essay on Technology, or The Question Concerning Technology, that's what it is. And he's asserting that there's something different about modern technology than about like the wheel, right? And he doesn't quite, Heidegger never quite answers your questions exactly, but like it seems to me reading that essay, and I think it's a fairly legitimate point, that once technology gets to the point where we can literally destroy ourselves as a species, like something's changed significantly there, right?
Right.
So he writes The Question Concerning Technology post-World War II because, of course, this is when the atom bomb has been unleashed on the world, right? Mm-hmm. So Now, was it the case that man could seriously mess up before that? Absolutely, right? It's just that the repercussions were never like world ending.
Like literally,
right? Exactly. So, but yeah, I think, I mean, this is the, there's always a danger with great, like, freedom and power, basically, right? So like, you know, we could have like a rabid dog on the loose, and maybe that dog could could bite like 10 or 15 people, right? Or we could have something even more deadly, a deadlier animal, right? But like, even the most deadly animal, right, is only going to do so, can only do so much damage to human beings, right? Or to the rest of reality, right? A really deadly man can cause the death of literally millions, right? If not more.
We saw that in the Holocaust.
Exactly, right? So you see, like, but notice that that's not because human beings are less than animals. It's because human beings are like have more gifts, are greater than, have logos, have, right? I mean, and so, to use the sort of like Uncle Ben line, right, from Spider-Man, right, like with great power comes great responsibility. I mean, it's not a lie, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if he knows that he stole it, but Stan Lee stole that from Tertullian, who is an early church father. And what Tertullian says is, to whom much is given, much is exacted, right? Or expected is another way to put that. To whom much is given, much is expected. And so, like, with human beings, much is given, right? Much is given. And therefore, much is expected. But a lot can go wrong, too, right?
If you don't, yeah, okay. I'll move on to this next question. I think we'll get at my next idea. The idea of being as a gift suggests that there is both a giver and a receiver. However, just because being is created doesn't necessarily mean it's a gift. I think you said that in the lecture. To say that God must create, that creation was necessary, seems incorrect, as it would violate God's freedom. On the other hand, the notion that God created the world on a random whim doesn't seem right either. This is a quote from your lecture.
Yeah.
As it would violate the concept of God as logos, reason, or truth itself. What do you have to say about this quote that you had?
Yeah.
I think it's important.
So just for your listeners, right? So I wrote on and continue to write on this kind of like obscure German philosopher named Ferdinand Ulrich, who does both metaphysics and meta-anthropology. And Ulrich's thing is, he says that the best way to describe being, right, is as gift, right? Whereas like, for example, like Aristotle would never use that phrase about being, right? Toti and I, he would Aristotle would never call it a gift, right? And Plato would never call being a gift. Right? And so the big question is, when you're reading Ulrich, is like, why does Ulrich think that this is the best way to describe being as gift? And Ulrich basically says that if we think that the world is created, right, then gift makes the most sense to describe being, right? Because here's the reason. On the one hand, you could say that God made the world by, like, because he needed to. So, like, a lot of the early, what we would now call pagan systems kind of thought that the world was created out of some need of the gods, right? They needed people to serve them, right? Human beings were created for like serving them and giving them stuff, right? But like, what does that mean then? That means that the gods needed the world in some way, right? And that doesn't seem to fit quite right. Like, who is this God that he needs like these puny humans,
right?
Right? So that can't be right. It can't be that God, that the world comes about by through need, right? Because that would violate God's power, right? But on the other hand, it also doesn't seem quite right that the world just kind of like comes about as a spasm, right, of God. Like, he's just like, I just created on a whim one day because I felt like it.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't seem right either because, as I said in the lecture, right, like, that doesn't seem reasoned, right? And then that would violate God as truth.
Okay.
Right? So, like, how do you navigate between thinking of the world as coming about because God needed the world versus thinking of the world as coming about because, like, just out of some, like, sort of spasm of God. Which, by the way, like, Plotinus, who is, like, the most famous Neoplatonist, I would say, more or less comes to that conclusion, that it's just kind of like a spasm of the one.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And he lived after Christ. Did he know about Christ?
Well, so this is, like, a big question about Plotinus's interaction with Christianity, right? Okay. So, but, like, Plotinus more or less comes to the conclusion that, like, the world's almost like a spillover of God, right? So then you don't have, like, reason, right? So Ulrich says, okay, I think the best way to think about this is as a gift, right? Because think about when, like, the best gift either you've ever given somebody, right? Or you've ever been given, right? You never have to give a gift. If you, like, are forced to give a gift, then it's not a gift, right? It's like a manipulation, or it's like an exchange or something like that. Like the best gifts are, like, just kind of, like, freely given, right? So there's reason behind it, right? Like, you think about what you're giving the person, right? There's an order to the gift that you're giving. Like, the best gift you've ever been given, the reason it's the best gift you've ever been given is because clearly the person who's given it to you has thought a lot about you, right? Like, that's why you're sort of like, oh my God, like, you thought so much about this, right? Like, that's, so gift helps us understand that it's not simply out of need, because you never have to give a gift, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also not just like a random whim, right?
Because then it wouldn't be a good gift, probably.
Exactly, right? Like, you know, suppose I was, like, walking down the hallway and I was like, oh, Gabe, like, I have this, like, bar of soap, like, you know, like, that kind of thing. Bars, I don't understand. People give soap all the time as gifts. But that's not a good gift either, when you're just like, meh, you know, like, gift has thought behind, like, a real gift has thought behind it, right? But it's never, like, you're never forced to give it, right? And right. So that's one of the reasons Ulrich thinks that the best way to think about being, right, God giving the gift of being, or God creating, right, mm-hmm. is as a gift.
It's a beautiful message, I think. And some days, I'll go outside, the sun will be out, it'll be, you know, I'll feel great. I'll just do well on a paper. I'll have something exciting that weekend or whatever.
Yeah.
And then being is, I mean, just existing is amazing.
Yes.
I can't wait to see what's next. And then there'll be just completely the opposite.
Right.
A terrible day where you feel terrible and you're like, why am I here? This sucks. Like,
yeah.
Why am I forced to be here? But I guess I'd say that in my experience, the former occurs more. And I think that when people talk about God and debate about God, like, Sam Harris does a really good job kind of exposing or using evil as a argument against God.
Mm-hmm.
How would you get into dialogue with someone when they're saying that, I mean, how can this life be a gift if there are children dying every day, innocent people dying? Like, I know this is, like, the problem of evil that would take a long time to talk about, but for Sparks Notes or something brief on this note, like, how do we work through this?
Yeah. So my question to people, I mean, and, you know, this is something I had to work through myself too. But my question to people is always, like, why does evil upset you so much? Right? So, like, the 2-year-old who dies of cancer, it's horrible. Yeah. It's awful, right? You can't even, like, it's a 2-year-old, right? That's how much more innocent can you get, right? Mm-hmm. Why does that upset you?
It almost seems like they didn't get a chance to, it almost seems like they were, like, their actions didn't affect the outcome of their life.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you're a horrible person if you say the 2-year-old, like, brought it on him or herself, right?
Yeah.
Like, at least, I mean, not at least, but, like, with somebody who, like, smokes for 20 years and then gets lung cancer, you're kind of like, right? But the 2-year-old gets cancer, I mean, there's nothing, right?
Right.
But the reason you get upset is because it shouldn't be that way.
That's what it seems like.
Right? That's why we get upset. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is, how do you know that?
I don't know. How do I know it shouldn't be? Because this idea I have of innocence, I think is, I guess because I think that the things you do should affect your outcomes.
Right. Okay.
That seems to be the logos of,
okay.
That seems to be the order of the world to some degree, right?
Yeah. Sometimes, right?
Not all the time.
But like you have this idea that it should be otherwise.
Yeah.
And my question is, the world is like a horrible place a lot of times.
A lot of times.
So where are you getting this idea that it should be otherwise?
Right, okay.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, where?
There's
where
a standard that can't be from this world because messed up stuff happens all the time. That you somehow know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I know about the messed up things? Like the
No, that you the standard itself, right? So like
the standard of like a perfect
Yeah, or just world or like something. It shouldn't be that way.
Or just yeah.
Right? It should be otherwise.
I'm comparing reality to that standard.
Exactly. But where does that standard come from? Because it can't come from our reality.
Because we know nothing else.
Exactly.
Where does it come from? Interesting. Oh, so that would suggest that it comes from some heaven or some like
some idea. Metaphysical reality that like we have some kind of access to.
And so when you bring up the idea of a 2-year-old dying of cancer, then you might say, well, now they're in heaven. Is that the justification?
I mean, I'm not justifying it. Right. Yeah, but I'm just saying my point is when a 2-year-old dies of cancer, everybody's upset.
Right.
If somebody's not upset, we would basically be like, you're a monster.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. Why is everybody upset? Yeah, this is just that. Nature, yeah. Man.
Right.
You see what I mean? If it's just nature, nature just works like that. It's a thinning of the weak. That kid's DNA sucked.
Yeah.
Right? None of these are good answers, by the way.
No, of course.
Right? Everybody reacts poorly to these kinds of answers.
Okay.
But if there is no standard, like literally a metaphysical standard, right? Then why shouldn't I be able to say, the kid's DNA sucked. I'm glad he died at 2 so that he didn't continue to pass his genes on.
Why
shouldn't I say that?
Well, it seems like a terrible thing to say.
I agree with you. Okay, I agree with you. But what I'm saying is you saying that's a terrible thing to say means that you are appealing to some kind of standard saying it shouldn't be this way.
Right.
Where does that idea come from? Kids die all the time at 2 years old.
Oh, it's just like innate in us that we have this idea.
Okay, but it can't come from nature.
Right. It doesn't come from nature. It has to come from God or something.
So, whatever. Something, right. Whatever, I mean, I tend to be very like slow to jump all the way to God. Sure, right. But it's got right. Just in my pedagogical method, ultimately, yes, I think that's true. Right. It comes from God. But like my point is to students, like it's got to come from somewhere. This idea, this horror you have at a 2-year-old dying. Right?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of where it can come from. Like, what would the scientist say? What would a very good scientist who's really thought about these things say?
So, like, somebody might say, oh, it's convention. You're just not, like, you've just been taught that it's horrible.
Oh, and it's not actually horrible.
Exactly. Right? So, like, a very strict atheist. So, this is why I have an issue with Sam Harris.
Yeah.
Because he appeals to evil. But the only reason you have a sense of evil is because you have a sense of what should be, right?
Right, right.
Evil is like, hey, it shouldn't be this way. Where do you get an idea of how things should be?
Hmm.
And if that only came from us, right, then or only came from this reality, right, then there would be no reason because like bad stuff has happened since the beginning of time.
Right.
Right? That standard or whatever it is, right? This idea that we have that it should be otherwise has got to come from somewhere else. It can't come from this world.
Okay. Interesting. And that's where the metaphysical
studies.
Okay.
Yeah. But notice that you start with like just the regular data of reality, right? Like you just start with like, hey, like why am I upset over this, right? Like, or why does this like produce a reaction of like just horror in me, right? Like you,
right.
And then you sort of be like, well, wait a second, like 2-year-olds die all the time. Mm-hmm. Literally, right? Like, and it, and like I would say it's horrible every time, but like if 2-year-olds like die all the time, then where do we get this idea that they shouldn't?
Right. Interesting. Something I'll have to think much more about. My next question is about the true gift giver. You said that in the lecture, and I'll paraphrase, I think, that the true gift giver doesn't expect anything in return. So if some being created being, and it is, or say God did create being, and it is a gift, as Ulrich describes, you also mentioned earlier that humans have this responsibility to properly pursue their telos. And so it seems like we have this gift, but we do have to give something in return. Mm-hmm. So help me understand this.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is another way that I think thinking of being as gift helps, right? Because, like, as I say in the lecture, right, like, if you gave me a book, right, like a book you really loved or a book that you thought I would really love, right, and then, and like I received it, but then I like used the book as like a doorstop, you would probably be like, that's not exactly what that book was for.
Right? Yeah, I'd be upset.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So it's not that like, so you gave me the gift freely, mm-hmm. right? And you're not like expecting anything like in return, but there's a logic to the gift, which is in this case to be read. Right.
Right.
And so like by using the gift against its logic, the gift giver, in this case you, right, would be somewhat put off by that. Right.
Right, right, right.
And so you may not give another gift. Right. Okay. Right. That kind of thing. Now, that's a little bit anthropomorphizing God a little bit too much for my taste.
Okay.
But there's something about like if the gift of being really is given by God, then there's a logic to it, right? And so like our like responsibility is to actually like follow the logic of the gift, right? The same way that when you give me a book, you kind of expect me to read it, right? So like it's not that God expects like you know, the way that in the Euthyphro, like Euthyphro says, like the gods expect like
sacrifices
and you know whatever from humans. It's not that God wants that, but if he's given us this gift of existence or this gift of being, then there's a certain kind of logic to it because he is logos, right? So if he's given us a gift, this gift of being, and there's a certain kind of logic to it, then we can sort of think that through and be like, okay, then our task, we might say, or our responsibility is to kind of like continue that logic or take care of that logic.
Well, great. I got through all my questions and asked some at the end there that were kind of absurd, but so thank you. But thank you for taking the time. I know you're busy. It's the beginning of the semester, and I hope we'll do this again. This is technically part two.
Part one is still up.
This one was a little more focused. I really liked this.
Yeah.
So thank you.
All right. Thanks, Gabe.
Okay.